You're listening to Let's Talk Creation with Todd Wood and Paul Garner, the creation show where we learn, grow, and worship.
Well, it's great to be back for another episode of Let's Talk Creation with Paul Garner and Todd Wood. I'm Paul Garner.
And I'm Todd Wood.
And welcome to all of our new listeners, and welcome to all of our loyal regular listeners. It's very good to have you. As always, remember to subscribe and hit the notification bell and like and share our episodes. It's great to see our audience continuing to grow, and we can do that, obviously, better with your help. So that's all very welcome. Now, Todd, before we get into the topic for today, which is a really interesting one, I think we need to say a word or two about fundraising. We're kind of in that season of fundraising,
yes,
aren't we?
Yes, it is. It's time for a pledge break, unfortunately. Those of you Americans know about pledge breaks in public radio and public television. So just a little reminder here, especially with Core Academy, we are looking to raise another $30,000 for the end of the year here. And most of that is obviously going to be put towards sponsoring this podcast. So if you enjoy this podcast, we would appreciate your contributions. A typical episode for the podcast, just a regular old ordinary me and Paul and maybe a guest, that's about $600 in terms of both the time that we spend preparing the episode and the time that we spend in production and so forth. So it's pretty expensive, and you get it for free. So it makes sense now that you would, you know, maybe open your wall a little bit and send us a couple of bucks if you've enjoyed this series. And this year was a little bit more expensive, Paul, because we spent a lot of time in person, which added
bit
of expense to our budget, and we're going to plan some more in-person stuff for 2024 as well. So if for Core Academy, you can visit coresci.org/donate to find out how you can help support the podcast. And in the EU or in the UK, Paul, where would we go?
biblicalcreationtrust.org, and you'll see there's a link to our giving page, and all of the information is there about how to give, all the different ways to give, including a link to our PayPal account.
Great. All right. And if you do want to sponsor an episode, $600, we will be happy to consider your topic for a future episode. We did two of those this year, Paul, and I thought those were kind of fun. The Behemoth episode, yeah, and the Joshua Tree episode was also a sponsored episode. So if you would like to actually, you know, make a contribution of $600 and say, please do this topic, we will seriously consider it. And if we, you know, if you want, we can talk to you about your idea and maybe we can refine it and come up with a really good episode for 2024. So thank you for your support. And now let's get on with this episode. Pledge break over.
Yep, that's great. Okay, well, in this episode, we are going to be taking a deeper look at the Nephilim. Now, viewers who are longtime viewers of the podcast might remember that we did actually sort of touch on this topic way back in episode 27, I think it was, when we were doing viewer Q&A. And Todd, you had this series on your own, was it the Core Academy YouTube channel,
where
you had this sort of Ask a Creationist series, and you talked about the Nephilim there. So, you know, having kind of covered this already, Todd, why are we doing another episode about this?
Oh, that's a very good question. Why are we doing this again? it's a fascinating subject that is, there's just so many dimensions to it. And so much has been said. It's an astonishing thing. If you go to Google Scholar and you look up Nephilim, there will be dozens of papers on this, even recent papers. People never get tired of talking and writing about this subject. So we thought, you know, there's always new things to learn and new things to discover. So why not give it another go and see what we learn this time.
Yeah, sure. And we'll probably dig into some different aspects to this question. So Let's kick this off then by having a look at the biblical references to the Nephilim. Just in case there are any people out there listening to this who aren't familiar, with exactly what we're talking about. Right. So the main passage that kind of everybody gets excited about is obviously Genesis chapter 6 and verse 4, which I will read. This is the King James Version, Genesis 6, verse 4. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. So that's kind of the key passage that people think about. And it's a very strange passage. We've got this reference to the daughters of men bearing children to the sons of God. And that obviously raises all kinds of questions. Who are the sons of God?
Right.
Are they descendants of the godly line of Seth, as some have suggested? Are they royal princes, as others have suggested? Or perhaps are they supernatural beings, fallen right. angels, or something like that? And when you begin to look at the commentaries about this passage, you don't have to go very far to realize there's a lot of disagreement about this. There are all kinds of different interpretations. And then, of course, we've got this cryptic reference to the giants. There were giants in the earth in those days, which is the Hebrew word Nephilim. So that's where this word comes from. And of course, there are all kinds of questions about who or what are the Nephilim, and what's their connection, if any, to the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men? So there are all kinds of questions. And you began to sort of talk about some of that in your Ask a Creationist episode.
Right.
And you took a position which I had never heard before.
Oh.
So just tell us about that.
Great. I kept reading that passage over and over again and trying to prepare that episode of that series. And I just came back to this idea that, I'm not sure this passage is saying that the Nephilim are the offspring of the sons of God and daughters of men. Because it's a very peculiar phrase, right? The way it says it, there were giants in the earth in those days when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men and they bare children. So am I supposed to understand that that is an obvious, the children are the Nephilim? Or is that just telling me, oh, by the way, the sons of God and daughters of men thing happened when the Nephilim were around? And so I sort of, in that video, I came to the conclusion, I think it may be telling us that the Nephilim are not the same as these sons of God, daughters of men. Which, honestly, was a surprising conclusion to me. But really, I'm just trying to read the passage and understand, what exactly is this saying? It isn't clearly saying, oh, by the way, when the sons of God and daughters of men had children, those children grew up to be the Nephilim, which are the heroes of old. That would be clear, right? That would be a very clear wording. But this one seemed to be quite odd and ambiguous.
Yeah. So I kind of see what you're saying. Is this reference to the sons of God and the daughters of men a kind of parenthesis in this passage, which
right.
is really then talking about the Nephilim, who are these mighty men of old? Maybe there isn't this sort of direct connection between those two things. So I kind of get that. Now, I'd never heard that before.
Right.
I'd always kind of just heard this assumption that the Nephilim are the offspring. And that kind of goes against, a whole lot of readings of this passage.
right. So my reading, this idea that maybe these Nephilim aren't the offspring, that's like, flying in the face of millennia of interpretation of this passage. So, hey, I might be wrong. And what do I know? I am not a Bible scholar here. I'm simply, reading this in various English translations, trying to understand what it says, and noticing the peculiar phrasing here, is it just because I'm outside of the culture and I don't understand how things are phrased in that culture, or is it because it's really, you know, not supposed to be connected the way I've connected it? But yeah, you're right. Jewish and Christian commentators have understood the Nephilim to be the offspring of the sons of God and daughters of men for millennia. So yes, I'm weird. Sorry about that. Maybe we'll just focus on the more common interpretation in this episode and forget about my peculiarities.
Yeah. So why don't we do that? I mean, that's interesting, because we'll put a link to your Ask a Creationist episode in the show notes. So if people want to go and hear that, they can kind of follow that up. But kind of let's explore for now this more sort of traditional reading. So, you know, when people start talking about the Nephilim, you know, again, people tend to focus on who are the sons of God, who are the daughters of men, and that obviously is an important aspect of the passage. But we want to focus in a bit more on the Nephilim. Now, there's at least one other passage in the Old Testament where the Nephilim are directly mentioned. Mm-hmm. And that is Numbers chapter 13 and verse 33, where we have the account of the 12 spies who have returned from scouting out the promised land.
Yep.
And they come back to report to Moses and to the people of God about what they've found. And they give this this very negative report. They basically say, you know, we can't do this. The land is unconquerable. And here's what they say about the occupants of the land. It says, "And there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants. And we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight." So again, this is the King James version sort of rendering of this. And again, we have this word Nephilim being rendered as giants. And it seems that this understanding that the Nephilim are giants probably comes from this passage. It's probably from Numbers,
right,
where we have this sort of comparison. You know, there are these people, and we seem like grasshoppers to, you know, in their sight. So that's where this concept of giants comes from, I think. Is that right?
Sounds right to me. Because Genesis 6, like you say, it never says anything about how big they are. It just says, right. It just says that, well, I mean, if you think that the mighty men are the Nephilim, then that's what it's describing. They're mighty men. And looking at this passage, you get sort of the same sense that these mighty men are, these giants are mighty men. And this is the only place where we have Nephilim connected to any sort of size measure. So I guess translating this, you would see, okay, well, the Numbers passage makes them tall and big, and then the Genesis passage must also be talking about tall people, really tall people.
Right. Right. So really, that sort of that reference to tall people in Numbers is sort of being read back into the Genesis passage.
And it makes sense that it would be. Most of the time when you're translating, you're looking for how the word is used in context in various places to understand the best way to render it. And so the idea that, you know, you would get a passage where that describes the giants, well, then that makes sense that you would translate that. Yeah. Now, this was the report of the 10 spies. Let's remember that. And there were two spies that said, nah, we should go up and do it. And that was Joshua and Caleb. That's going to be important here in a minute, because we're going to find some more things out. But I think this passage raises kind of two big important questions. And the first question is, should we take these spies seriously, these 10 spies seriously? Is that really, are these sons of Anak, the Nephilim, are they really that big? Or are they just exaggerating, trying to stress the idea to the people that we can't go in and do this? It's too hard. Is that what's going on?
Well, It's got to be an exaggeration, surely, because grasshoppers, you know, are very, very small. So, so the largest species of grasshopper is, you know, 7 centimeters long or something like that.
That's big.
And, you know, if I were proportionate in size, you know, to, you know, if I were a grasshopper and the Nephilim was proportionate in size to me, as I am to a grasshopper, then what would the Nephilim be? 135 feet tall or something crazy like that.
So, 40 meters at least. 135 feet. Yeah, big.
Yeah. So it's an exaggeration. I mean, they can't be saying these people were really 135 feet tall or anything like that. So,
and remember, you know, we just did the episode on Noah's Ark, and we discovered the largest land animal ever was Argentinosaurus, which is 70 feet tall. So you're talking about twice as big as that. That is difficult to believe. So I have to suspect that this is an exaggeration, right? So, okay, they're exaggerating. So I guess the next question is, if they're exaggerating, how badly are they exaggerating, right? Were these guys really super tall? So that I actually feel like a grasshopper standing next to them? Or are they, you know, 6 foot, maybe 7 foot, mildly tall? So that I'm just really, really pouring on the silliness here. That then goes back to the question of how should we understand what the Nephilim are, right? Because if this is an exaggeration, which we think it must be, then how badly are they exaggerating?
So did they correctly identify these big people as Nephilim?
Oh yeah, that's another good question. Yeah.
Yeah. And did they correctly identify them as sons of Anak? So these are difficult questions. So let's think about Anak. So Anak is mentioned 9 times in the Old Testament in the Book of Numbers when we have the spies going out to scout out the land. They're mentioned in Joshua when Caleb drives them out of the land. And there's one verse in Judges that also describes, you know, Caleb driving them out. And these sons of Anak, if you like, they're portrayed as fearsome warriors. Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 2 mentions that they're tall. And we actually have some names. There are 3 sons of Anak that are said in the book of Numbers and in Joshua to be living in the land. Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai. Judges, Book of Judges also sort of affirms there are these 3 sons of Anak. So the next question then, I guess, is, are these sons of Anak really Nephilim?
Right.
What do the spies mean by that? So, you know, we come back to this question. Are the spies simply meaning that these people are really tall and mighty warriors, and that's what Nephilim means? Or is Nephilim a reference somehow to parentage? Which kind of takes us back to that traditional understanding of Genesis 6, that these are somehow the offspring of sons of God, daughters of men. Nephilim is something about their unique parentage. What do we make of all of that?
So right, yeah.
We have to remember this is the report of the spies. Okay, what's being reported here is what the spies say. And when we question what the spies say, we have to remind ourselves, we're not questioning biblical inerrancy. We're not questioning biblical authority. Sometimes what the Bible does is it reports incorrect statements that people make.
Yep.
It reports lies that people tell.
Correct.
And what we're trying to get to the bottom of is what these spies are reported as saying, is it correct? Yeah. Have they got this right?
Yeah,
so
right.
That's the question.
Yeah. So I'm going to... It seems to me, I guess there could be 2 things going on here. One could be that there, well, maybe three. I mean, I suppose you could have a parentage issue. I suppose you could imagine a situation where one of Noah's daughters-in-law had Nephilim parentage. And so it turns out that now the Nephilim have survived the flood. But that's only if you think that the Nephilim must be only the people who were the children of the sons of God and daughters of men, right? The other option would be that the sons of God and daughters of men continued, you know, there were more sons of God that came down wherever they came from and cohabited with the daughters of men and produced even more Nephilim after the flood, which that's odd. Or I suppose you could say that I think in my mind, it's easier to think of the Nephilim as being this mighty warrior description. The Nephilim is not a people group, right? It's not a clan or a family designation. It's a description of being a mighty warrior before the Lord, right? The mighty men of renown, I guess. That would fit this passage, I think, better, right? Without having to worry about, oh, you know, where are these Nephilim coming from? How did that happen? Yeah. And all that stuff. You just say, well, they remind, so either Nephilim means, you know, mighty warrior of renown, or giant, or they're saying these people are so big they remind us of the Nephilim, of the stories of the Nephilim from before the flood. And yeah, I guess you could go, either way, but I think the numbers passage, I think it's easier to just go with the idea that this is a description of that Nephilim is a description of the quality of the people. And we should also mention here the irony, the beautiful, delicious irony, the spies complaining that we can't take on the sons of Anak because they are too big and they're too strong. And it is one of the spies that ends up driving the Anak out of the promised land when he gets in there. Caleb does that. That's specifically mentioned. So you got to think that there's some irony going on there. God does love irony. So if you say we can't do it, then he'll show you, oh no, you can.
Yeah, I think what you're saying kind of makes a lot of sense, that this term Nephilim is something about the quality of these people. It's, you know, it's about them being mighty warriors rather than an issue of parentage. Because, yeah, I've always puzzled about how you end up having Nephilim around after the flood when presumably, you know, the Genesis 6 passage is right before the flood and presumably they're all wiped out in the flood. So
it feels like in that Genesis 6 passage that this is presented as an example of the wickedness that needed to be wiped out by the flood. Yeah. So the idea that it would pick right up again after the flood, that's a little odd. I don't know.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So this kind of leads us to another question then, which is, what does the word Nephilim even mean? You know, we've kind of bandied this word around. And I understand, I'm no Hebrew scholar, but I understand that the most common Hebrew sort of etymology links the word Nephilim to the word Naphal, which means to fall. Although that's not completely certain. It's obviously very difficult. When you've got a word like Nephilim that's only used three times in the Old Testament, it's kind of hard, you know, to be really certain about its meaning and how it relates to other words. But let's assume for the moment, if Nephilim is related to this Hebrew word to fall, what does that mean? Does that mean that the Nephilim are fallen sons of God? Is that sort of consonant with this idea that they're fallen angels? Or might it be in the sense that they cause others to fall?
Right.
You know, maybe they're conquerors, they're tyrants, mighty men who cause the downfall of others. You know, this, we don't know. There's not much to go on.
Right.
But there is an interesting link here. This this etymological link, because there's another possible usage then of this word in the Old Testament. You might remember when we spoke recently in another episode to Doug Smith all about the Masoretic text, that we learned that Hebrew is written only in consonants. And, you had to kind of fill in the vowels, if you like, for yourself. You had to know what the word meant. And, of course, this sometimes introduces some ambiguity. There is a reference in Ezekiel 32 and verse 27 where Ezekiel talks about the mighty that are fallen. And the word fallen in that text has the same consonants as the word Nephilim. So, is that another reference of some kind, to the Nephilim? It's an interesting question.
Yeah.
We'd have to say, have the Masoretes got the vowel points correct? Should we understand this as Nephilim or as fallen, or what does it mean? But there's another possible link there.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. But you're right. I mean, Doug told us that the one of the big contributions of the Masoretes was to add all those vowel points. So they put dots and lines around the Hebrew letters to indicate, what the vowel sounds are supposed to be, so that they could preserve the original way that the Hebrew language would have been pronounced. These words would have been pronounced. So yeah, I mean, if you think the Masoretes got this one wrong, then I suppose it could be that these were the mighty Nephilim in Ezekiel. But we don't know. And
we don't know.
Like you say, there's only three times this is used, so we're back to sort of speculation. We're gonna have to put that in the category of speculation, and we'll have to maybe think about other ways of thinking about what this might mean.
Yeah.
And so we don't lack for any other means, and that's, I think, quite interesting. So there, the common interpretation of at least the sons of God and daughters of men, it might go back to an extra biblical book, so a religious book that was written basically during the intertestamental period. That was written, it's kind of apocalyptic. It's talking about the end of time, but it also talks about the beginning of time. And that book is the first book of Enoch.
Mm.
And yeah, so this is extra biblical literature from the Second Temple period. And so if you're not really up on all that jargon, which a lot of us, why would we be? But anyway, Second Temple, of course, is the temple that's built by the returning Israelites from the exiles. The Jews come back from the exile, they rebuild the temple. That's the Second Temple. So this covers Second Temple period, runs from the time of the return all the way up to the destruction of the temple in AD 70. And it was a time of a lot of writing, right? So we have right in the Bible, Ezra is a scribe. He is a professional writer, essentially. And he copies the law and makes sure that people understand the law. That's right out of the Bible. So there were a lot of other things written at this time. Protestants may be familiar with the apocryphal books. Books like Tobit and Judith and Maccabees, those are written during this time period. And then there's a bunch of other things that the Jews and the Christians never really took seriously as important biblical books, if you will. And so the Book of Enoch is one of those sorts of books. Now we have examples of the Book of Enoch that are quite early. We have fragments of the Book of Enoch written in Aramaic that are found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we know that the Book of Enoch, just from external evidence, we know it must date to be quite early. And so the estimation, most scholars think it was put together from different pieces of material, and that the part that we're interested in is probably 3rd century BC. Now today, the only surviving full copy of the text is written in an Ethiopian language called Ge'ez, which is a traditional language of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. So the Ethiopian Orthodox, they conduct their liturgy in Ge'ez, and Ge'ez is the language in which we have the full copy of the Book of Enoch. Otherwise, it's just fragments, right? So chapters 6 through 8 of the Book of Enoch give a rather dramatic and imaginative retelling of Genesis 6, 1 through 4. And it starts out with the birth of human women that are very beautiful. And they catch the eye of a group of 200 angels. And these 200 angels decide, all right, we need to go and marry these women and have children with them. That's literally what they decide to do. And they know it's an act of rebellion. And so they actually make a pact with each other that they're going to do this and they're going to accept the curse and whatever. So it's very interesting. And it names them. So there's a whole passage there where it names the chief of these angels and who these angels are. Azazel is one of those angels. That's a name you might recognize from pop culture that pops up in various fantasy sci-fi things from time to time. And Azazel is originally from the Book of Enoch as one of these fallen angels. So they come down and they marry these women. Each one chooses one to be the husband to, which is, I thought, quite interesting. No polygamy among the fallen angels. Even the fallen angels don't do polygamy. and then they teach them naughty things. So they teach them things like herbology, right? Which would be associated with sort of folk magic. They teach them alchemy. They teach them astrology. And interestingly enough, they teach them how to use eyeshadow. So sorry, ladies, if you're really into makeup and stuff. That's a naughty thing, according to the Book of Enoch here. Secret knowledge taught by the fallen angels. And they teach them how to make weapons and armor. So they're helping them to figure out this whole how to be a warrior, right? So they're sort of giving them the tools to fight and kill. And so the women have children, of course, and the children are the giants, and they are 200 cubits tall, which would be 300 feet, which would be twice as big as what we guessed the Nephilim would be if we were the size of grasshoppers. So that's still really, really hard to imagine. Actually, not twice as tall. That 300 cubits would be 450 feet. So that would be like three times as big. Very large.
Yeah.
Very large. All right. So the problem then comes with the giants, the giant babies. They're very hungry. They eat up all the food that's available, and they start eating people. And eventually, apparently, they run out of people, so they start eating each other. So now we have giant cannibal babies eating people, eating everything in sight. Which makes sense, because babies always grab stuff and put that in your mouth, you know. You've had a baby, or you've hung around babies for any length of time. You've noticed that. You're always going, no, don't put that in your mouth. So, same deal here. Giant cannibal babies eating people. And then we have this verse, and the people cried, and their voice reached unto heaven, and so God starts making plans for the flood, which will wipe out these giant cannibal babies. So, there you go. That's the Book of Enoch, well, Paul.
Well, there we go. I must confess, I've not read the Book of Enoch, but I'm sort of intrigued to go and read it now. I think.
Yeah, at least that. Passage, you know,
that's all very imaginative, and I think you can sort of see how that becomes influential, at least in some respects, to, you know, how Genesis 6 is then being interpreted, where we have this reference to the Nephilim. So the Book of Enoch is dated to the earliest about 300 BC. That must mean, you know, Enoch is not really the author.
Right,
you know, because
we should mention that. They call it the Book of Enoch, but it's not really written by Enoch.
It's not really Enoch. It's a later interpretation of Genesis, basically. It's sort of riffing off Genesis and elaborating the stories. And there's about 1,000 years, you know, between the time when, you know, Moses writes Genesis and when the Book of Enoch is written. So when we read the Book of Enoch, we're not really reading what the original readership of Genesis thought that it meant. We're reading what the author of the Book of Enoch thought that it meant, which was a very long time after the closure of the, you know, after the writing of Genesis, and even after the closure of the Old Testament canon.
Right.
But nevertheless, it had an impact. So the Book of Enoch had an impact. We know, you know, it was being widely translated and widely read. We've got fragments of Enoch in 6 ancient languages. So, and we've got quotations in several of the church fathers, including Irenaeus and Tertullian. So although it wasn't accepted as authoritative scripture, it was hugely influential. Nevertheless, it was being read. And so it was then influencing how Christians thought about the biblical Nephilim. Interestingly, they're not picking up necessarily on this idea of kind of 300-cubit tall giants, but they are kind of picking up on this idea that the sons of God were angelic beings, and that the daughters of men are a reference to sort of fallen angels intermarrying with human women. That's a theme that is being picked up. And then we've got these weird offspring, the giant cannibal babies. So it's really interesting. But having said that, you know, this idea that the sons of God are angelic beings is not solely coming from the Book of Enoch. So there are, I think, biblical reasons for people to think that that's what the sons of God refers to. Because, for example, in the Book of Job, we've got this reference to the sons of God referring to angels.
Yes.
And we do have this reference in Numbers that kind of makes the connection between the Nephilim and sort of people who are very tall giants. So, it's all very interesting. I hope our listeners are kind of following all of this so far, because, you know, the more you get into this, kind of the weirder it gets.
Yeah.
And the more
it's gonna get weirder.
Aspects to this there are, it's going to get weirder. Okay.
Yeah.
Take us on.
Yeah. So you have that aspect of the Book of Enoch. I don't know that that's the earliest book. There's another extra biblical book called the Book of Jubilees that also has this idea of the Nephilim being giant and the fallen angels being their fathers. And, you know, it's hard to say because there's just not a lot of manuscripts. It's relatively easy nowadays with libraries and so forth to trace down who originally came up with this claim. If you work hard enough, you'll find the earliest reference. And here, it's difficult to know. But Enoch is definitely illustrative of what was going on outside of the Bible as they were reading Genesis 6:1-4 in the few centuries before Christ. So yeah, the earliest Christian authors then we have seem to be siding with the Book of Enoch and saying that this is, that these are fallen angels marrying human women and having giant cannibal babies. And then in about the 2nd century, we have a different interpretation sort of coming to rise. And that is this idea that these are really the offspring of the line of Seth, right? So that the sons of God are intended to mean that Seth's family was righteous, right? And yeah, that when they started hanging around with those Cain girls, right, the daughters of Cain, well, then that's when everything started going to pot. So yeah, that's less weird, right? No demon human hybrids, no giant cannibal babies. It's just this is an illustration of the common kind of corruption that we see when we sort of go from being moral and upright people to hanging around with the wrong crowd, and then we corrupt our own morals in doing so. It was what the Israelites did when they got into the land, right? They did not drive out the people, and so they started, you know, doing the same sort of idolatry that the people did. So,
yeah.
So that would then be, you know, explain sort of how when God decides he's got to destroy the world, that all flesh has corrupted its way, because even the godly line, the last of the God-worshipping people had given up and gone after, you know, women with loose morals, if you will, or whatever. So, yeah, now there is there is one more odd twist here. When I first envisioned this episode, Paul, I did not expect us to bring this up, because I don't generally take this sort of thing seriously. But you said, you know, we should talk about aliens.
Yeah.
And
well, this is what comes up when
it does
in popular culture, when people talk about this passage, this question inevitably comes up. We can't avoid it, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. And this is much more recent in origin. And so obviously in the late 19th and early 20th century, after all that, so there was always this question of, you know, as people began to recognize the other planets in the solar system were planets like the Earth that we're on, celestially speaking, they're not in orbit around the Earth. We're all just planets in orbit around the sun. People started thinking about other people in other worlds, right? Could there be people on the moon? Could there be people in Mars? And of course, as the emergence of sort of science fiction and sort of speculative fiction starts off in, say, the 19th century, you have people throwing out this idea, you know, it could be that aliens have already visited Earth, right? And so this sort of goes on in pop culture, and people know this today. I mean, if you guys have seen those Thor movies from the MCU, right? Thor is an alien, but he's also the god of thunder, and that's because he's got this alien, whatever it is, alien power, alien technology that makes him the god of thunder. And he, many years ago, you know, encountered the people of Earth and they worshipped him or whatever, all that stuff. That's all ancient alien stuff. So that's a thing that starts off. And then in the 70s, when you and I were just growing up, it becomes hugely popular. I remember it was just everywhere. Everyone was talking about the ancient aliens. And they were talking about the Nazca lines in South America, those weird shapes that are formed from rock piles that you can only see from the air. People were talking about Stonehenge and all these sorts of things. And there's no way you could make those things because, you know, ancient humans would not have done that. They couldn't see the Nazca lines. You'd have to fly to see the Nazca lines. You couldn't build Stonehenge. You couldn't build the pyramids because that's not possible. So all of this is coming from one source. And Paul, I think you have that source right there. Yes, there you go.
Here we are. From my weird book collection. Yeah, Chariots of the Gods by Eric von Daniken.
Yeah, Eric von Daniken. Yeah, that was where it all came from. So in the 70s, when this really became super popular, it was all out of von Daniken, and a big chunk of what von Daniken was arguing was that all of these ancient stories of mighty heroes and miraculous encounters and angels and whatever, miraculous healings, all of that is just ancient people encountering advanced technology of aliens.
Yeah.
And so that's how the pyramids got built. That's what made Stonehenge. That's why they made the Nazca lines, because that was markings for their UFOs coming to Earth.
Yeah,
you remember all that, Paul.
I do. I do remember it, all of that. And, I mean, this was a hugely popular book. I mean, it I don't know how many millions of copies this must have sold. And it spawned a whole series of sequels and documentary spin-offs and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And as you say, it got picked up by lots of, you know, other people too. This is another book from my weird book collection, The Spaceships of Ezekiel. which is by a NASA engineer who kind of took the von Daniken's suggestion that the description in Ezekiel, where he has, you know, his vision of the wheels and the living creatures, that this is actually a description of a spaceship. This got developed into a whole book about Spaceships of Ezekiel. There was another book I recall. I think I've got that somewhere as well. The Manor Machine, you know, the Ark of the Covenant was a kind of machine that, you know, the aliens used to communicate with Moses, and they were able to produce manna, you know, using this machine. Yeah. Okay. So.
Yeah.
Lots of kind of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of sci-fi writers love. But this is the context in which people then look at this biblical passage, Genesis 6, and they say, you know what? The Nephilim were aliens.
Yeah.
Okay, so the sons of God are aliens from another world that come down and cohabit with human women, and the Nephilim, these are these human alien hybrid beings, this kind of hybrid offspring. And this has just become an enormously popular sort of cultural idea. It's out there in the culture, and every time you talk about the Nephilim, this comes up.
Yep, absolutely, every time. And I hope I this kind of goes without saying, but we're going to point it out anyway. This is not Bible friendly.
Right. Okay.
Right. So making the Ark of the Covenant into an alien communication device that produces bread for people, that's not biblical, right? Turning Ezekiel's wheels vision into an encounter with UFO, that's not really biblical. I've never really been one to address these sort of modern interpretations. But you're right, it's embedded in the larger culture. And for some reason, it just has this amazing capacity to capture our imagination when we see something really startling from the ancient world, right? When you see the scale of the pyramids, it's just shocking. When you see the Stonehenge, right? The size of those rocks, or of course Easter Island, that was a big one for this too, right? Mm-hmm. Those big giant statues. And you think, yeah, there's no way people could do that by themselves. They would need what we have, bulldozers and excavators and all the machinery that we have to be able to do that. The funny thing,
there's a lot of chronological snobbery going on here.
There is,
about the capabilities, right? of the ancients.
Yeah, but because we have, at least in the case of Egypt, we have copious evidence of how these pyramids were built. We have the remains, Paul, of the actual quarries where the people were carving out these rocks to make pyramids and monuments out of. Right? We have their tools left. We have partially carved out monoliths and obelisks and all sorts of things. So you can see, you can see how it was done. We have engravings showing the people dragging the rocks around to build the pyramids. This is not some secret, amazing thing, puzzle that needs to be solved. It's right there in the historical record. You just have to look.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it kind of reminds me of the Noah's Ark episode, right? Where we said, you know, when you first hear it, you think, oh, that's interesting. And then you think about it and you go, wait a minute, that would never work. But then when you actually crunch the numbers, you realize, all right, well, that's not as bad as I thought. Same deal here, I think. You have a lot of people who sort of shallowly think, oh, yeah, how would you build something like that? And they think, there's no way. And then, but when you actually dig into it, you find out, oh, yeah, it's really not that big a deal. So I think a lot of it, I think a lot of that is a lot of this is driven by people's, like you say, chronological snobbery, right? It's just no way that they could have done that. Now, aliens, let's just say a few words about aliens. Because NASA's been releasing all this stuff about their UFO files, and people are getting all excited about it. It's kind of becoming a little more popular. I'm seeing it pop up in my social media feeds and so forth. Not that I spend a lot of time on my social media feeds, but, you know, in the little time that I do spend, there they are, these UFO things. So I know there are Christians out there who have a very strong opinion about UFOs and aliens and so forth. I know, for example, Creation Ministries International and Gary Bates have long had a very strong opinion that this is deception. This is some sort of demonic deception trying to trick us into thinking that, you know, I don't know, some sort of trickery going on here. So maybe before we wrap up this part of the Nephilim stuff, we should at least say something about aliens. You got any thoughts on that subject, Paul?
Yeah, well, talking about UFOs, undoubtedly people see unexplained things in the sky. I mean, there's no doubt that people do. And, you know, even when you've accounted for all of the hoaxes and the misidentifications and the planet Venus and, you know, whatever it is,
right?
There still sort of remains this little core of things that seem quite inexplicable. But does that mean that people are seeing alien spacecraft? No, it doesn't mean that. It just means that we don't know what they saw. They could be natural phenomena we don't know about. You know, ball lightning and these weird sprites and things that people talk about in the upper atmosphere. There's all kinds of natural things going on that, you know, maybe we don't fully understand. Military technology, you know, is there military technology flying around that we don't know about? Almost certainly, yes.
Sure. Yeah.
Could there be some kind of spiritual element? You know, could there be some demonic deception? Maybe, you know, possibly. But I don't, for all kinds of reasons, I don't think that we're being visited by aliens, biological creatures from another world. You know, there's this broader question of the plausibility of alien life and then whether that life could visit here. And maybe that's a topic for another episode, because I think there are all kinds of interesting theological and biblical sort of implications of those sorts of speculations. But I, for all kinds of reasons, I'm skeptical about it. I'm skeptical about the idea of alien life, at least intelligent alien life. And even if it was there, I'm kind of skeptical that it could visit us. So, yeah, that's... Those are my very unformed thoughts.
Yeah, like you, I don't really spend a lot of time thinking about this. I got enough to think about in my real life. And my knowledge of aliens is mostly science fiction, right? Doctor Who and Star Trek and Star Wars and whatever. I love that stuff. That's fun. You know, fun stories, neat, but I also recognize the brutal reality of outer space is just these vast distances that are not easily overcome. And so I remain skeptical of the idea that there could be biological life on other planets. Now, biological intelligent life on other planets that is actively trying to visit us. On the other hand, could there be some sort of microbes, weird microbes, you know, lurking on the, you know, under the surface of Venus or on Europa or someplace like that? Sure, I think, why not? I don't know. Microbes and worms and stuff like that. I don't know. But I think, you know, it's probably more important for us to focus on our lives here and now, rather than speculating on, you know, what aliens might be about and all that sort of thing. I think, given what we have of God reaching out to us, the urgency of our need for repentance, the coming judgment that we Christians expect, there's plenty of good reasons to think about, you know, life on Earth first, and most importantly, rather than speculating on aliens and UFOs and all that sort of stuff. Just not something I want to get too obsessed with. But so I think we gone a little far afield of the Nephilim, the Bible.
We have.
And even Talk Creation. We're doing Let's Talk ET now. Maybe we should have a couple of parting thoughts. Anything, Paul?
Well, there's lots to think about. You know, I've tended towards the opinion that the sons of God were fallen angelic beings. That's kind of been a view that I've held for a while, but I'm not dogmatic about all of that. You know, I have this question: how could fallen angels have married human women and how could they have had offspring together? I don't know. I suppose I had always connected the Nephilim, you know, to the offspring of those unions. But you've given me a lot of things to think about, a different way of looking at that passage, which I think is really, really intriguing. And perhaps those two things are not connected in the way that I've tended to think. Whatever we think about all of that, something weird seems to be going on right before the flood that leads to the judgment of the flood. And I think everybody agrees that is a puzzling passage. And I think we're probably going to be puzzling over it for a while to come. So, yeah. So those are my thoughts. We have drifted a long way from Let's Talk Creation in this episode. I did not think when we set out to do this podcast that we'd end up talking about the spaceships of Ezekiel and giant cannibal babies, but there we are. We have, but that's it for this week. I think we've covered the topic and that's all we've got. So
All right. We
will see you in another fortnight's time.
Yep.
We'll see you then.
See you around.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Let's Talk Creation. For more information, visit us at letstalkcreation.org, where you'll find an archive of past episodes and all our show notes. If you'd like to leave a comment or make a suggestion, you can find us on all the major social media platforms. Let's Talk Creation is brought to you in the U.S. by Core Academy of Science and in the U.K. by Biblical Creation Trust. As a listener-supported ministry, we are grateful for all of your financial support. Find out how you can make a contribution at our website, letstalkcreation.org. Also remember to like, subscribe, and share this episode with your friends. Thanks, and see you next time.